Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, your mother, and your wife, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today, once again, is artist and bird lover, Miss Emma Gerard.
Birds escorted us as fish swam upstream while the sky spread out before us.
And we have yet another special guest today, writer, director, and disembodied voiceover, Jason Perlman.
As fate followed in our wake like a madman brandishing a razor.
On today's show, we're going to discuss the number 18 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Andrei Tarkovsky's Mirror. Listen up to see if our panel feels Tarkovsky's experiment is worthy of its high standing. And speaking of experiments, we're going to follow up our mirror analysis by talking more generally about movies with a challenging or non-existent narrative. We're going to talk about a few of our personal favorites, and also about what we find appealing about movies that eschew the standard three-act movie structure. Then we're going to finish off the show by talking about an upcoming project of Jason's. All right, guys, this might get kind of deep. We ready?
Ready.
All right.
Not too deep, though.
As you may have inferred, the poem we recited in the opening is from Andrei Tarkovsky's 1975 film Mirror, which is our first topic of the day. All of Tarkovsky's work was made under the watchful eye of the Soviet Union, and because of Mirror's unusual structure, the government ruled it elitist and only allowed a very limited release. Fortunately, critics have since rediscovered the film, and it is now considered to be an absolute masterpiece. It now ranks as the 18th greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Since I don't think summarizing the events of the film will do any kind of justice to what Mirror is about, I will simply say that it's a montage of memory. It's an autobiographical creation in which Tarkovsky combines surreal imagery, recreations of scenes from his childhood, his father's poetry, and historical newsreel footage to create a beautiful, hypnotic, confounding, unsolvable puzzle of a movie. There is no narrative to follow, and while the events of the film presumably happen at different points in Tarkovsky's life, in Mirror they all seem to reside on the same temporal plane. They are now memories which are presented as fragmented shards of the filmmaker's subconscious. The film shows how these fragments interact and recall one another. It is up to the viewer to determine whether the summation of these fragments encapsulate the essence of Tarkovsky, or even the more universal essence of all of human existence, or whether it's just a series of random images loosely bound together by the ramblings of an old Russian dude. Let's see if our panelists bought into Tarkovsky's vision. All right, guys. Are you a fan of Mirror? Jason, we'll start with you.
I am. I saw the movie for the first time probably about 10 years ago when I was first discovering Tarkovsky, and visually and the texture of that film has pretty much haunted me ever since. I just think the images in that movie and the suspended time that it creates truly is akin to a hypnotic effect. I mean, people always use hypnotic to describe Tarkovsky's work, but this film in particular is exactly that. It begs that you approach it in an almost subconscious, dreamlike state, and I think you get the most out of it if you just let it sort of wash over you in that way.
Yeah. Emma, how about you?
I agree with that. There are moments where you have to let it wash over you, and it feels dreamlike. Like when the poetry is reading, I found I was not focusing so much on the visuals that were happening or comprehending the scene that was happening. There was just sort of this like combination of words and images that sort of felt unlike a normal movie viewing experience to me. Mm-hmm. We're not searching so closely for clues.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I love this movie. I feel like as I'm watching it, I'm getting to experience what it's like to be Andrei Tarkovsky. This is about as close as I feel a movie can come to just looking through someone else's eyes. And it's totally mesmerizing. And it's beautiful. And I love how the movie feels really deliberate. Like, it is very stream of consciousness, but it all feels like they're individual memories are pieces of a puzzle that do combine to create a very deliberate picture. And that's, I really appreciate that because it doesn't feel haphazard. It doesn't feel like here's this memory and here's this memory. It all sort of fits together and it's very, it all feels tonally cohesive. So, but the meaning of the movie, I suppose it can mean just about whatever you want it to mean. But Jason, what does the movie mean to you?
Oh, man. It really could take such a multiplicity of analyses. But I think, and I'm certainly no expert in Russian history or anything of that effect, but in watching it and kind of zeroing in on the way that it is structured, starting out very much in memories of very young childhood, centering on the loss of a father who went away to war, and in this film we presume that that war is World War II, and then the movie descends into much more sort of, I wouldn't say pessimistic or cynical, but much more conflict, psychologically conflict-ridden episodes in this narrator's life, who we presume is Tarkovsky. And I think for me, kind of running with the title of the movie, I think that the grand sort of overarching point of the film is to show that the individual and all of these extremely microcosmic autobiographical memories in a way also mirror the societal and socioeconomic greater events that are taking place in Russia during the period of time that the film tries to encapsulate. Oh,
that's interesting. Riff and on that for me.
Yeah, because you see so much sort of larger world stage material interpolated into the film. You see the newsreel footage of the war, both positive and negative elements of it in terms of Russia's involvement. There's these scenes where there's this very triumphant and surreal hot air balloon liftoff that was actually a big achievement at the time, because these sort of aviators broke into the stratosphere by way of using these balloons. And then later we see images from the war that are an uprising of the Chinese and these bedraggled soldiers marching from a defeat. And, you know, it's not just the war stuff, but I think you do see a lot of episodes in the movie that parallel with some of the feeling of loss of innocence and stagnation that Russia experienced after World War II. Mm. And I think it's kind of through the desolation of the mother character that's really kind of the main character in the movie. We see her go through all of these sort of sad self-definition episodes, the loss of her husband, some poverty issues later on in the famous earring scene later in the film. And I think that all of these little vignettes, in a way, kind of mirror, to use the pun, you know, Tarkovsky's dissolution with the state of Russia after the war. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Brezhnev period that did see a lot of stagnation economically, and a lot of the Cold War tensions were very, very high at the time that Tarkovsky made the film. So I think that's woven in there in a very kind of subversive way, because it's so cloaked in autobiographical material.
Right, yeah. And so this, as I mentioned, this film was, if not banned, given a very limited release, the government disapproved. And it doesn't seem like they could really pinpoint why they disapproved. They're just, we don't like this. We don't know why. But perhaps there is that subtle message that things are not so great in society, and this is really shining a very personal light on, a very pointed light on that, so pointed that they couldn't really pick up on it.
Yeah.
Because to me, the historical footage primarily served as just a marker of where we are in time, because mm-hmm. the film does jump right back and forth in time so often. So, but that's it. You're right. It does. The personal is political or whatever. Mm-hmm. Emma, how about you? What did you take away from this?
Well, in like a less, you know, traditional form of the personal is political, I think it's really cool how the movie is so very personal, but I have so little in common with Andrei Tarkovsky. I think it's very cool to sort of like have these like images and like the way a child sees the world versus the way an adult sees the world, and to feel like this is like a big piece of art that I can, like, really connect with, that I feel like a similar, like, there are people in the world out there who maybe feel and think similar to me in a way that I can't get out of a movie about, like, you know, a bank heist or something.
So how does the view change when it's from a point of view of a child versus an adult?
There's, like, a lot of, one thing I was thinking about, a lot of Tarkovsky's movies I like because I'm really into, like, plants and abandoned buildings and stuff like that. And the stuff with the, where there's he's a childhood, there's a lot of, like, fields and scenes with, like, very powerful wind and, like, just sort of the, like, awe of nature.
Mm. And was that primarily the childhood scenes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then as an adult, mostly indoor.
A lot of interiors, a lot of, like, domestic spaces especially. Mm-hmm. It seems that, like, his family is very important in his adulthood. Well, in both parts of it. But, you know, the family that he makes with his wife.
Right, yeah. So the actress who plays his mother is the same actress who plays his wife. What did you guys think of that decision? Was that confusing, or?
I didn't think it was confusing. I was thinking, it kind of, like, made me think of, like, Peter Pan, how, like, you know, like, the father and, like, Captain Hook are the same people. Like, I was like, it's not, like, a new device, but it definitely has been used different ways. I was trying to think of something else I could compare it to. But it doesn't seem weird to me that it's, like, the same actress.
Yeah.
I think most people will look at it and say, this guy must have mother issues, but I don't know.
I don't think there's really a deep sort of Oedipal problem at work in the movie, but there is this real centering on mother and matriarchy, and he uses his own real life mother as the old woman who figures later in the film. And I think you know, it's just another layer of this whole idea of mirror and how relationships in life do mirror different periods of our time. Mm-hmm. Whether we do, you know, as people say, you know, a man seeks out a woman to marry that has qualities of his mother, and that might be, you know, something that he's tucking in there. But I think it's more to say, playing on that idea, and there are so many mirrors visually presented in the scenes as well, that all these different eras of our life do reflect upon one another. Mm-hmm. You know, they do catch facets of one time in our life and our values that get reflected back in a subsequent time and relationship, and that's that seems to be a real running theme throughout the film that's sort of visualized by way of this concern on mother and what mother means, Mother Russia, you know, what that whole concept is he's playing with.
Yeah. So as I was watching the movie, I was like, this feels less to me like watching a mirror than it does looking at someone's life through a prism. Mm-hmm. It looks like refracted memories. But it's interesting how, as you might say, like, the memories do reflect one another. So in that sense, it is like a mirror. So I wanted also to ask you about how you processed the movie as you were watching it. Did you find yourself trying to connect all of the memories together to try and, like, place a narrative on it, or were you able to just kind of let it wash over you?
I think you have to do it in stages. I mean, to watch this movie one time is almost kind of useless. I mean, it's so dense and it has its own internal logic that you can start to latch onto. I mean, I think it's a disservice to say that there's not a very intellectual, very determined structure to this movie and how he's put it together. I don't think it's just a hodgepodge. I don't think that I've personally cracked it, so to speak. But I think as you watch it once, you gotta take it in, like we said earlier, with that whole kind of dreamlike, hypnotic state, and let it just kind of get into your mind. But then when you look at it again and subsequently, however many times you have the patience to watch it, I think you do start to see connections and you do start to see repeated sort of patterns. And it's very clearly conceived by Tarkovsky's way of going through the story.
And how about you?
I kind of found, this was also my second time watching it, And actually, I was really amazed by how little I remembered from the first time I watched it. Actually, the poem stuck a lot with me, and the scene with the traveling supposed doctor or whatever he is. But anyway, I just kind of find that you just sort of stay in the moment with it. Like, short scenes, like, kind of seem kind of long, and you just kind of, like, get into them. And I think kind of naturally your brain sort of starts putting a narrative together. Like, you get a general idea that, you know, he was a kid, and his mom was single, and then they grew up, and he got married. But I don't think that necessarily matters as much. I did notice there's some, like, repeating images, too, which I think kind of serve to, like, bring your mind back to what's already happened so it doesn't all just sort of, like, pass you by.
Yeah.
It makes you, like, sort of reprocess things.
Yeah. So what are some of those images that you
noticed? Like that super slow motion black and white of the wind going over the field and it's knocking something over on a table outside. That one shows up twice.
Yeah, the wind does recycle as an image.
Yeah. And there are several, obviously, there are a lot of mirrors, but I noticed birds. This film loves birds. but that, there were just a lot of visual motifs that just kept repeating, and really, it felt like it anchored you a lot. And as Jason was saying, it does feel very deliberate. It doesn't feel like it was haphazardly thrown together. It really helps to keep everything grounded. I felt like you're not flying off in every direction.
And I think he does, I could be wrong, but I think he introduces some of his visual conceits that he revisits in all of his movies subsequent to Mirror in this film, with the rain in an interior space, and that amazing sequence pretty early on where the mother's washing her hair and the room starts to deteriorate around her. He uses that, and certainly in the end of Solaris, he uses it to multiple effect in Stalker. Certainly Nostalgia might be like the rainiest movie ever made. And Spilled Milk is always in his movies. And I think that presents itself for the first time in this too. So he's really kind of embedding his own seemingly visual grammar in this film that he revisits throughout the rest of his films.
So, but I mean, for me, when I'm watching the film, I will admit I was like kind of trying to connect the events of the movie together so I could construct some kind of narrative. And because I felt like the time displacement was kind of disorienting for me. So it was helpful that the historical footage was in there so that I could sort of, okay, now we're here. So I found myself trying to do that a lot, just figuring out where we are in the timeline. But I felt like the voiceover, the poetry, it's actually, the poems are Arseny Tarkovsky. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. I'm never sure. But that's Andrei's father wrote and is reciting the poems. And as soon as the voiceover would come on, I would immediately stop trying to make sense of everything and just sort of, all right, now we're just going to enjoy some poetry. We're going to take a sec and we're just going to listen to some poetry. What did you guys think of the poems?
I don't know. I think the way you kind of have to, where the poetry sort of forces you to take your mindset out of like putting together a story too, kind of, I feel like it's a big theme of the movie too, that like a human life might not be a straightforward story about I was a child and then I went to school and then I accomplished this and that. It's more about like the moments of like appreciation in between and like, appreciation for art and nature.
Yeah.
And sort of that way that we live in our minds in between.
So this question, I don't know if you have an answer for it, but Jason and I, we had a conversation once about how he doesn't like Tree of Life. And I'm wondering why. I feel like there's a comparison to be made between Mirror and Tree of Life, and I'm wondering why you respond so well to Mirror and not to Tree of Life.
Well, yeah, there's definitely similarity, and I think it goes back to the original thing we said about the film, which is that it's, you know, an individual kind of, it contains the universe in a way, and vice versa. You know, we're reflections of the exterior order of the universe, and it's kind of encapsulated in each of us or each microcosmic thing. But I think the difference in ultimate execution between these two films is that Tarkovsky didn't obviously get as ambitious as Malick did, and didn't go for a cosmic sort of statement, where I do feel Malick might have overreached a bit. And I think I just think that the human element in Mirror is, even if we don't kind of intellectually understand it fully, or even in much of it, we feel it in a way. Mm-hmm. And I didn't ever personally connect with Tree of Life in that way. I felt like I was always seeing at a distance a filmmaker trying and reaching to make a statement, or to make a connection, or to make a philosophical argument out of images. And I don't feel Tarkovsky falls prey to that in this. I feel like what he's done allows you to feel past the filmmaker and directly interface with the material, as opposed to Tree of Life, which does feel more kind of under a museum case to me. Mm. and less immediate as an experience.
Do you think Tarkovsky would have had dinosaurs in his movie, though?
I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility.
I really liked the dinosaurs, but I just get excited about it.
All right, well, we'll have to have you guys back for the Tree of Life discussion, because that is on the list. So I think it'd be interesting to have someone who can speak articulately about why they don't like the movie, as opposed to, it was boring. I get a lot of it's boring. And that, to me, is not an acceptable reason to dislike that movie.
It is a lot longer than Mirror, too. Mirror, even if you think it's really boring, it's only like 100 minutes long, I think.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. I will say, I do think it's the perfect length. Any longer, and it may have gotten mm-hmm. tedious, but because it is such a manageable length, I feel like you can really absorb everything mm-hmm. you're seeing. So, final question, guys. This is the number 18 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Do we feel it's worthy of that spot? Emma, we'll start with you.
I still think I like Stalker better than Mirror.
What?
I would put that up there.
Okay. All right.
Just
well,
personally.
All right. Fair enough.
I actually have to second that. I prefer Stalker as a film to Mirror. I really love that movie, but I think that Mirror is a more important movie than Stalker.
Okay.
In what it did as far as going into a non-narrative space and kind of opening that dialogue with Western audiences that probably had never, when they finally did get to see Mirror here, never really had seen something like it. And I think it's an achievement in how bold and creatively unique it was and is for its time.
Yeah. Emma, I need more explanation. Like, Stalker better? Okay.
Yeah.
Explain why.
But I think Jason's right. I think, Stalker is kind of more of a normal movie, so it's probably not as influential as Mirror. So I guess it should be up there on the list.
All right. I personally think it definitely deserves the number 18 spot. And while I don't think the movie is for everybody, I think that watching the movie is such a unique experience, and I do think everyone should at least give it a shot. As we discussed, Mirror is a film without a rigid narrative structure. It's more of a free association. Jason, would you contest that?
No.
Okay.
That's right.
Now, I don't want to speak for all Americans, but I know typically when I go see a movie, I expect that it will present some kind of story, and this story will have a three-act structure. A challenge is presented in the first act, that challenge is fought in the second act, and in the third act, the challenge is either overcome or it's proven insurmountable. But if this is a Hollywood film, chances are good that the challenge is overcome. Of course, there are times, even in mainstream cinema, where the structure is subverted. Citizen Kane, for example, doesn't exactly follow this formula to a T. Likewise, what some people often think of as impenetrable foreign cinema, like, say, French New Wave films, still usually employ this structure. However, there are filmmakers who aren't so married to this rigid narrative, filmmakers who maintain that the formal elements alone should evoke the meaning of a film. Filmmakers who believe that the events that unfold in their films should be a little opaque or open to interpretation. So without further ado, We're going to talk about a few of those filmmakers and what we like about their movies, and non-narrative filmmaking in general. So, let's jump right in. What is the appeal of a non-narrative film? Emma, let's start with you.
I like that a non-narrative film can sort of present a series of ideas in sort of an essay format or in a stream of consciousness format that a story might not serve.
Jason, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that non-narrative film can also be really about mood and about a feeling by way of it that's almost a subconscious, directly subconscious, directly engaging your subconscious, as opposed to obviously a narrative film is much more, you know, keeping you very frontal lobe about, you know, what's going to happen next. Is our hero going to get bested by the villain and stuff like that? I mean, I think that you can get into a much more almost dreamlike situation with a non-narrative film that connects into a different part of the mind.
Right. And I was thinking, I feel like movies are one of the few art forms where we expect there to be a narrative and where the primary appeal is the narrative. We don't expect a narrative out of music most of the time, or when you go to a museum and you're looking at paintings, you're not necessarily looking for a story, necessarily. That's not always the case. And with music, it can, you know, everyone loves music. That is universal. So I think that part of the appeal of a non-narrative film is to try and tap into what makes us respond to music and other art forms, and just color and all these, the elemental things about the movie that we respond to. But that being said, a lot of people will not watch movies without a story. So why do we think that is?
I just think that obviously we're trained from childhood, you know, storybooks at sleep time, and then throughout the rest of our lives to expect a narrative, to expect a journey of a character. And I think that's something very deep in human DNA. I don't think it's necessarily just cultural. I think, you know, we look back at all kinds of, you know, tales and stories that were handed down by way of just auditory reciting in primitive cultures, and that's just something that's part of our human heritage. And I think we expect it and we look for it because it's something that helps us understand our own experience.
Well, I think you're right that it is a lot of a matter of training. Like you're talking about, you know, we don't expect paintings to all be the same, but I think there definitely was a point, you know, like if you were in Europe in the 19th century, you probably would expect to go to a gallery and see a landscape history scene of either European history or Greek mythology, and stuff that was outside of that seemed really radical and difficult to look at. And I think, you know, some people still find, say, a Jackson Pollock painting difficult to look at. So this is a matter of like getting used to a non-narrative format.
Yeah. As I was thinking about this topic, I was actually talking with Jason about possible subjects to go along with Mirror, and I suggested, I think, non-narrative, or I forget what exactly I said, and Jason suggested the films of Stan Brakhage and Maya Deren. So that's kind of heady. I'm like, well, these films tend to be kind of heady. And then that got me to thinking about a movie that possibly is slightly more lighthearted. And so that got me to thinking about Fantasia. And it's interesting how, Jason, you said that we, from young age, we are taught to expect a film to tell a story. But somehow children still really respond to Fantasia. Yes, Emma?
Well, you know, Fantasia bombed when it first came out, and it was re-released in the late 60s, and people would take acid and go to Fantasia, and that's when it made all of its box office money.
Okay, well, maybe we should talk about the use of drugs while we're watching this. Is it recommended to take drugs before you watch piece of non-narrative cinema. Does that enhance the experience?
I don't think it can hurt.
Okay, but is that, do you feel like that's a requirement, or can one enjoy?
No, it's not, certainly not a requirement.
Okay.
But probably does enhance a bit.
Okay. Well, then, what do you think is the correct way to view a non-narrative? Should we, before we get into this, maybe we should jump into a couple of examples of our favorites.
Sure. I guess some of the first non-narrative stuff I saw in an early film class long, long ago was Maya Deren's Messages of the Afternoon, and certainly Unchained and Lou, the Salvador Dali and Louis Buñuel movie. And both of those stuck with me throughout the years. I was quite mystified, particularly by Messages of the Afternoon. It has a very, very dreamlike structure and is really kind of about a dream. Sort of the protagonist, if you call it that, falls asleep in the beginning of the film, and there's very, very interesting music that accompanies the film, and it just creates a, for lack of a better word, a dreamlike atmosphere that's really kind of intoxicating. And if you just go with that and let yourself kind of get into that part of your brain that responds to that, I think it can be very rewarding to watch a film that's structured and goes for that type of feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that Meshes the Afternoon is so evocative. Like, there are just so many emotions that it stirs up. Just that feeling of being trapped. That movie kind of makes me claustrophobic, but I love it.
Yeah, it's creepy for sure.
Yeah.
And the mirror-faced figure.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I think some of those movies also were really kind of drunk on Freudian psychology back then too, and we're trying to kind of do a sort of a thesis on some psychological ideas that grew out of Freudianism. So, you know, I don't think they're just purely experiments. I think they're also in a way kind of taking up some psychological argument and trying to, you know, visualize it if that's even possible. But they do their best.
Yeah. I think a lot of the like surrealist goal is to this idea that Freud had, that things in your dreams mean other things because they look like other things. So they were doing a lot of like making visual puns, and I think that's why it like works so well in film and painting.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to understand what's going on to understand that, like, a furry teacup is, like, kind of a funny joke.
So, Emma, what are some of your favorites?
I was thinking about how a lot of documentaries don't have a long narrative structure, and that they sort of, like, kind of make an essay-like argument about something. Koyaanis Katsi was a big one that came to mind. It actually doesn't even have any dialogue or words in it. It's just a presentation of footage of different.
Well, it does say Koyaanis Katsi.
Oh, that's true. Kind of over and over and over again. Which, if you don't speak Hopi, it's Hopi, right?
I think so, yeah.
And so it means nothing to you. sort of more like a mantra. But I think when people watch the movie, they do feel that there's this sort of story, or not a story, but a thought about the way our lives are being told.
So as I was saying, I was thinking about Fantasia in this context, and that got me to thinking about other animation, actually. And a lot of experimental animation is non-narrative. But a few people that I wanted to mention, there's Norman McLaren, who's actually a British animator, but he works primarily in Canada. And he made a lot of pieces of animation that are basically just images. They're geometric shapes set to music, very strange music. But he's probably best known for creating the short film Neighbors, which is a pixelated movie based stop motion, a kind of stop motion about two grown men fighting over a flower. And I believe it won an Academy Award. But he made many, many pieces of short animation, and most of them are completely abstract, and or a great many of them are completely abstract, and they're absolutely beautiful. Mm. And I enjoy watching them because, one, they're beautiful, and two, I just remark at how much work must have gone into making these things. Animation is so labor-intensive, and they're really still, to this day, absolutely beautiful. And well, a couple of examples, there's Boogie Doodle, which you can watch on YouTube. There's Spheres. There are a whole series of them all available on YouTube. And if I had to guess, I think Meshes of the Afternoon is probably on YouTube. But I have not confirmed that. Also, another animator that I wanted to quickly mention, Jan Svenkmeyer, who was a... Yay!
That's great.
Another very labor-intensive pieces of... more labor-intensive pieces of work. This employs primarily stop motion, but Jan Svenkmeyer, Czechoslovakian, now I guess it's Czech Republic, but most of his most famous works were made under the watchful eye of the Soviet Union, and they would from time to time object to some of the things he was saying. But he used stop motion animation, a lot of puppetry, also claymation, to make these very subversive pieces of animation. I guess his most famous work is probably an adaptation of Lewis Carroll's Alice story.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, I guess, Dimensions of Dialogue might be his most famous series of short films. And those are all amazing and definitely worth checking out. So and they're really dark, but and
they're
creepy.
Funny, though.
But they're also really funny. He pulls off this remarkable feat, which is to have this very... these really scary images of skulls and clay devouring itself, but it also manages to be very funny.
Yeah, if you like Tool videos, I think you'd love Svenkmeyer's work.
Or Brothers Clay.
Yeah.
To get in touch with that, your emo teenage side, but slightly more subversive than Tool videos, I'd like to think.
Well,
I don't know.
A lot
not.
About like food and sex are very big. They're all about human appetite.
Exactly. Jason, did you want to talk about any other favorites?
Yeah, I really like the work of Stan Brakhage, who's had something of sort of a renaissance in public awareness. I think recently they put out an amazing Criterion collection of a DVD compendium of his work, and he went about as far as anybody's gone with non-narrative filmmaking. I mean, he started out with actual humans interacting and went into very, very mythologically based work that I think was very based upon the book The Golden Bough, which I believe was by Graves, which kind of anthropologically saw connections between all of these mythologies that kind of run between cultures and across cultures throughout time. And Brakhage really took that up in his most famous film, which is Dog Star Man, which is very, very mythologically based and also... owes a lot to the poetry of Ezra Pound, which he was very influenced by, the Imagist poet Ezra Pound. But in his later work, he, talking about, painstaking and laborious filmmaking, he started painting directly on individual frames of film. And he would do things like glue moth wings to celluloid and then run it through a projector in a movie called Mothlight. That's a short film that's literally moth wings with light projected through them. But these projects of his as he got into his latter stage are really fascinating to watch. I mean, there's no narrative. I mean, we're looking at just, basically moving paintings and... I don't really know what he was trying to achieve with that, but it's beautiful to watch. And I actually, you asked sort of what's the context or reason to watch non-narrative films. And quite honestly, I've had parties and dinner parties at my home where I'll put on Stan Brakhage's work on a TV because it's beautiful to just kind of catch out of the corner of your eye now and again.
Mm.
Which isn't to say that it shouldn't be watched in its entirety and really digested, but It's pretty mind-boggling work that he did.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say that you put on Dan Brackage films at your parties and you all gather around and watch.
No.
I want to go to your party.
And then everyone left. Actually, I went to a party once that was playing Jan Svankmajer movies.
That seems like an awesome party.
It was a little off-putting, actually.
Did everyone avoid the food afterwards?
You know, they were serving Bloody Marys, too. It was a weird party.
It's like a great party. This is a Halloween party?
It was a birthday party.
Bizarre.
Did you have any other suggestions?
Yeah, I wanted to also pick out Gummo, because it's actually a really popular movie that people don't seem to have any trouble watching, but it did occur to me that it's pretty non-narrative. Yeah. It's sort of like vignettes about a little city and the community in a town. I think just the visuals and the music help people get into it. I think because it's more contemporary than like Mir or, I mean, I know Tree of Life's a newer movie, but it's a little hipper, so I think it's easier to jump into it for a lot of people that way.
Why do you think it's hipper?
I mean, it's like about like youth. Like there's like metal music and Chloe Spitty's in it.
Song.
Yeah.
I love that rooster.
It's really
song.
It's like bright and it's like got a little bit of a punk aesthetic to it. So I think that makes it easier.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, since Gummo does seem to be slightly more accessible, how can we convince people to watch some of these movies? Is it make it hipper? Do we need to include Chloe Sevigny? Sevigny? would that do the trick? I don't know. What's your best pitch?
Well, I mean, I personally think, you know, a lot of what modern filmmakers perhaps have learned from the non-narrative filmmakers of the past is to incorporate some of those stylistics in parts of their movies. You know, if it's a dream sequence or a drug sequence or something that psychologically and experientially is best articulated through those types of filmmaking, then I think, you know, it's an easier pill to swallow if it's sort of snuck into a narrative film when either the experience of a character or something in the flow of time and in the movie would be better told using some of those techniques. But I think, as a film in its own right that's just fully experimental and non-narrative, it is tough to convince someone to watch it, because I think if they don't have a real abiding interest in the medium of film or their filmmaker themselves, it kind of makes you feel stupid because you scratch your head trying to make sense of it. And our wiring is such that we always kind of want to put label and description and compartmentalize what we're seeing. And if you can't and it's not coming easily enough, we turn off to it, we get annoyed at it and annoyed at ourselves and feel like a dunce. So I think if you can approach it just from sort of an artistic interest and as a, you know, somewhat of a completist of the medium of film, then there's a lot to be mined from watching these films.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought too, because Gummo is about, lower class people and younger people who are growing up poor. So I think that might not feel like it's putting on airs the way that an art movie might people feel alienated from.
Yeah, I do. I feel like when you watch a non-narrative film, oftentimes it's like you have to put on your museum hat. You know, I'm like in an art gallery. My living room is now an art gallery. And maybe some people just are not interested in doing that at all. But I think that might be, you're right, I think that might be why people are more open to watching Gummo. It doesn't feel like it's putting on any airs. But I think we should end on a positive note and just say, you know, all the movies that we mentioned are worth watching and worth checking out. And for the most part, they're pretty easily digestible. I think if you watch Meshes of the Afternoon, I think you'll get, it will elicit some response. Mm-hmm. You might not like it at all, but I think it's interesting and it's not very long. So just give it a shot.
And a lot of them are on YouTube for free.
Exactly. You don't have to pay any money. Don't you want to see moth wings glued to pieces of celluloid? Come on.
That's only like 30 seconds exactly. long. I mean, that's not – you can watch that waiting in line for your latte.
Exactly. There you go. As I mentioned at the top of the show, our friend Jason here is a writer-director, and he's got an exciting movie project in the works called Threshold. I've asked him to come on the show and shamelessly plug this upcoming venture. So without further ado, Jason, tell us about Threshold.
Okay. Yeah, I'm making, this will be the first feature film that I myself direct. It's also a film that I wrote. It is a narrative film. It actually is a story.
Bummer.
But has a lot of eerie surrealism that I think is very much from influence of some of the films we've discussed. The film basically is about a young couple that very tragically lose a child, and a mysterious woman breaks into their home one night where there's all these kind of apocalyptic events going on in the world, and it's a very odd, frenzied type of night. And this woman knows all of these impossible details about the loss of the child and about the couple's dynamic as well, which starts leading us to believe that she might be an angel or a spirit guide, and the world is ending in this night. So it plays with a lot of interesting mystical types of sensations and ideas, and it's really quite a eerie type of film.
Mm-hmm. Would you say it was influenced by Tarkovsky? Is there a direct influence?
You know what? I probably. Yeah. I've been a fan of Tarkovsky for a very, very long time, and I think that he does eeriness better than about anybody out there. I mean, he's one of those directors who's able to just shoot a frame where there's really not necessarily anything distinctly eerie or threatening going on, but it creates this feeling. It creates this kind of dread. And, you know, that's something that I am very influenced by, and that is going to play a very big role in how we plan to shoot this film. So yeah, probably somewhere in some neurons is Tarkovsky having some influence on it, for sure.
Yeah. So like, this is your first feature film that you're directing.
Yeah.
What's that like?
It's a lot of stress.
Yeah.
But I do have the luxury of a lot of false starts, which means that I've had a long time to do my personal preparations for the film. We've tried to shoot it a number of times, and for one reason or another, it's gotten delayed, whether because of a casting issue with cast having their schedules come into conflict to be able to shoot this, or financial issues with our budget and so forth. So this time we really have everything kind of slotted in place, but the period getting to here has allowed me to really feel confident in my own preparations.
Yeah.
As far as really having a very deep awareness of how to shoot it and what kind of mood and texture I want throughout and in particular scenes. So it's been a very, very vindicating and it's been a great process, actually.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
I knew Jason primarily as an editor, so it's been very, very heartening to watch as he's taken on this other role, and it gives me great hope for everybody's future, I have to say. I'm very, very happy you're now going into production.
Yeah, it's
on
exciting.
Your first feature film. It's very exciting. But you'll have to keep us updated
on your
film.
Of
okay.
course.
All righty. And if listeners want to find out more, is there a website or anything?
Yeah, it's thresholdmovie.com.
Okay, so. Well, you'll have to, again, keep us abreast of what's happening. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. What are some of your favorite examples of experimental or non-narrative cinema? Come let us know on our show page, flickswise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. You can follow us on Twitter @flickswise. But most important of all, subscribe and leave us a comment on iTunes. It'll really help us stand out in the database. We get lots of comments and ratings. On the next episode, we're going to discuss Stanley Donen and Gene Kelly's classic Hollywood musical, Singin' in the Rain. A fun one, guys!
Very different.
Yes. Until then, Jason, thank you so much for coming on the
show. Thanks for having me.
I know you're going to be kind of busy in the coming months, but hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Sure.
All right. And Emma, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
All right. And you're coming back. All right. Talk to you soon. Should we do a Nostrovia?
Yeah. Nostrovia.
Nostrovia.